And we will start in verse 31 this evening because, along with last Sunday night's requested study of how to understand God's sending, using an evil spirit to Saul, tonight we've also been asked to look at the actual battle between David and the Philistine champion, some tall guy by the name of Goliath. Now, we've been through these verses before. We looked at all this a couple of weeks back, so we're not going to read all of it again. We're going to go through it. We're going to try and focus more on the three main characters, and there are three main characters here. There's David and Goliath. Who's the third one? Saul. Saul is the third one. All right, chapter 17, 1 Samuel, the first half of Samuel, if you have a Hebrew Bible. Verse 31, and when the words were heard which David spoke, remember David saying, who's offending the God of Israel? Well, what are you guys doing? Remember that? They rehearsed them before Saul. So they went and told Saul what David said. And he, Saul, sent for David. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go. I'll go and fight the Philistine. This almost, without trying to be disrespectful to the Bible, this almost has the ring of humor about it. Something that doesn't quite seem real, maybe, but it is real. We want to observe Saul first. Saul is the king of Israel. And have you ever considered that Saul, right now, here in this particular spot, doing and saying what he's saying, is in a state of disobedience to Yahweh? Do you know why? Well, keep your finger there and turn back to chapter 9. Do you remember when God was instructing Samuel, you know, that he's going to anoint this guy, Saul? He doesn't tell him who it is. But in 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 16, the Lord says to Samuel, tomorrow, about this time, I will send thee a man. I laugh at that too. I'm sorry. I'm going to pause a lot because this life of David thing is fabulous to me. Tomorrow, about this time. Did God really say about this time? Could not God say that at exactly 1:27 and 35 seconds? Well, of course he could have, but he speaks on our level. He says, tomorrow about this time, I'll send a man to you out of the land of Benjamin, and you will anoint him to be captain over my people, Israel. Purpose clause. So that he may save my people out of the hand of the Philistines. For I've looked on my people, and their cry has come up before me. What did God say the new king would do? That he would save my people out of the hands of the Philistines. Who was given the primary responsibility to save the people specifically from the Philistines? Saul, the son of Kish. Saul ben Kish. So Saul, sitting on the sidelines back in the safety of his tent with the Philistines on the other side, is in a state of disobedience to God. He should be down in front leading the armies of Israel against the Philistine champion. It is his responsibility. He is the leader. He is the king. He is the one responsible. That's what God would want Saul to do. Now let me just say that disobedience on the part of some almost always provides an opportunity for others to be obedient and blessed. Disobedience on the part of some almost always provides an opportunity for others to be obedient and be blessed. Saul, verse 33, said to David, thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth. And that means a young man in his late teens, in all probability, 17, 18. And he is a man of war from his youth. Saul is also a critic. It's easy to sit on the sidelines and be a critic. It's easy to criticize. Criticism is cheap. If criticism was more expensive, maybe fewer people would indulge themselves with it. Saul is also presumptuous. He doesn't ask if David or why David thinks he can fight for him. He simply assumes, and he says, this isn't going to happen. Saul is doing what, unfortunately, many humans and even Christians also do. Saul is looking on the outward appearance of David, and he's not looking on the heart of David. David's heart is after God's own heart, and if Saul's heart was after God's, he would know that. Saul's heart is not after God, and he is looking on the outward appearance, and he's making a judgment based on what he sees with his eyes. Goliath will make the same mistake in a few verses further here. Anyway, David defends his experience, and he defends God's actions on his behalf, God's protection of him. And throughout this account, I probably won't mention this again, but pay attention to who mentions God and who doesn't mention God. Verse 34. David said unto Saul, thy servant kept his father's sheep, meaning me. I kept my father's sheep. And there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went out after him, and I smote him, and delivered it, the lamb, out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard, and smote him, and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine is going to be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. David moreover said, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. That's a pretty convincing argument. And Saul says to David, well, I can see your mind is made up. I'm not going to win this battle. Go, and the Lord be with thee. Now, we can legitimately ask the question, was Saul sincere there? There's no way to know. Was he sincere or not? But we can sure exercise some sanctified speculation. And I suspect he's not sincere, just like he wasn't sincere in last time we looked at him, in that he loved David. I don't think he's a genuine person. Verse 38. Saul armed David with his armor, and he put a helmet of brass on his head. Also, he armed him with a coat of mail. David girded his sword upon his armor, and he assayed, interesting word, to go, for he had not proved it. And David said unto Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David put them off of him. And he took his staff in his hand, and he chose him 5 smooth stones out of the brook, and he put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had, even in a scrip, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. Now, I'm pretty sure that just out of this room right now, I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 at least qualified men, and we could come up with a bunch of sermons about the difference between Saul's tools of battle and David's tools of battle. I'm sure none of you guys have ever done that, have you? Of course not. What I want to look at is the word assayed, not for long. It means to begin, to make a beginning, to show willingness or to undertake to do a thing. What it means here, the way it's used, is that David is showing a willingness to obey Saul, to please Saul. Well, I'll try your armor because I really... This is why some of these passages, I find humor in them. I really don't think David expected them to fit. I don't think that Saul, if he's in his right mind, and that's challengeable, really expected them to fit David either. Remember, Saul stood head and shoulders above everyone else. Of course this armor isn't going to fit David. Back to chapter 9 real quick with your fingers stuck in 16 or 18, 17, wherever we are there. Chapter 9, verse 2, there was not among the children of Israel a goodlier, there's an old English word, person than Saul. From his shoulders and upward, he was higher than any of the people. Saul is no small strapling himself. Any of the words youth and all those things and ruddy and all that you could apply to David do not apply to Saul. He's a big guy. Something that stands out here is that David is facing the giant alone. And this is how it is sometimes in life. We face our giants alone. There are no armies alongside of us. There are no counselors next to us. There are no backups right behind us. We stand there alone. What does it mean? It means that when you are standing there alone, you have no choice but to trust the Lord. Yeah, we say this, I've said it already tonight, the battle belongs to the Lord. But you're the one standing there before the giant in your life. The giant person, the giant issue, the giant problem, whatever the giant is, you're the one standing there. When there's no one with you, trust the one who's promised never to leave you or forsake you. Quote the scriptures. Go forward, trust the Lord. Next thing. I have no idea why David chose 5 stones. The Bible never comes out and says Goliath had 4 brothers. Nice try, sorry. Doesn't say that. But we can address a few things about the stones and the slings. All the way back in 1939, a guy with the first name of Ovid, who would name their kid Ovid? Ovid Sellers, who wrote in the Biblical Archaeologist, the sling David used was not the toy catapult with which children play, namely a slingshot. It was an ancient offensive weapon that shepherds also used to control their sheep. Shepherds usually made a sling out of a long, thin strip of leather and formed a pouch in its middle. Talented slingers could propel small objects hundreds of feet at very high speeds with great accuracy. And then he quotes a verse. We're going to read it in a second. Pictures of slings and stones from that time show the stones typically being from 2 to 3 inches in diameter. Probably David's stones were about the size of a modern baseball, maybe even a little larger. David beat Goliath not with the weapons of a warrior, but with the tools of a shepherd. Now the verse that he puts in there is Judges chapter 20, verse 16. Among all this people, there were 700 chosen men left-handed. Every one could sling stones at a hair's breadth and not miss. Now, we're not done. Look at verse 41 in 1 Samuel 17. Because now things are truly going to get serious. And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. So here is Goliath, all 10 foot 9 inches of him. And here's the man in front of him holding with both hands his over 100 pound shield walking in front of him. How'd you like to be that guy? Yeah. When the Philistine looked about, there he is.
little David. Here's what he says. He disdained him, verse 42, for he was but a youth and ruddy and of a fair countenance. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air, to the beasts of the field. Whew. So excited to go to battle against this guy. David said to the Philistine, now pay attention, this is priceless. Thou comest to me with a sword, and with a spear, and with a shield. But I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into my hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee. And I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, so that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Do you remember what I told you? I haven't said it in years. The ancient Near East, when these nations came out against one another, it was a battle of their gods. My God's bigger than your God. My God's bigger than your God. And when they captured the other people's God, they went and put it in their temple. Picture Samson and Dagon and the Ark of the Covenant taken into that temple. It was my God's bigger than your God. No, he's not. That's what this was. And that's David is saying, everybody's going to know that the real God is in Israel. And this assembly shall know, verse 47, that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. All right, three or four things. First, Goliath, as I mentioned, looks on David's outward appearance just like Saul did. This seems to be happening a lot to our young hero. I should go through the text and count how many times we're told that he was a youth and ruddy and goodly to look on, because it's a number of times. Goliath's primary weapon is also our greatest fear. It's intimidation. And he's good at it. Oh, is he good at it. What am I, a dog? I could just see two fourth graders on the playground doing this kind of, I could just see it. Except this is real. This is serious. Bullies usually are, by the very nature, intimidating. And they can usually back it up. The bully who beat me up in fourth grade was intimidating, and he backed it up. When we feel intimidated, and I know this from firsthand experience, our brains turn into mush. We may even, and I've done this too, physically shake. And we forget how to use our words. And we all too frequently forget how to pray, if we even remember to think about praying in the first place, because our brains are mush. We end up focused on the giant in front of us rather than the God who is for us. Big mistake. Second thing. I don't know how many of you folks have thought about this, but I think that David has preached his first sermon here. Follow me now. He calls out the pagan's error, his sin, faith in the wrong things, his arrogance and his pride. Well, don't you have to point out that people are sinners first? Okay. David tells him what his fate will be. I'm going to decapitate you, dude. That's going to be the end of you. He tells him the reason that this will be a public execution, so that all the earth may know there's a God in Israel. And then he closes with where all the glory will go, to the Lord. That's a pretty good sermon outline. Implied in there, because remember, this is Old Testament, but implied within all of that is the opportunity always there for Goliath to repent. At any time There was nothing stopping Goliath from saying, you know what? I'm too big to be picking on a little guy like you. Let's go get a coffee and talk about your God. But he never does. Can you imagine how that would have gone if Goliath had repented and became a follower of Yahweh? For us, remember what we said. The battle does belong to the Lord, and yes, we are in the battle, but even if we lose in the eyes of the world or in the eyes of other believers, have you ever done what was actually right and allowed yourself to be stomped on by someone else, and even other believers don't understand why you didn't defend yourself? Let me tell you, we experienced that when we stood up at Piedmont and said, this is not what Dr. Stevens intended for this school to be and do. We stood up. Nat and his fellow pastors stood up when they took on the state of North Carolina for homeschooling and Christian schools. But even Christians, and you probably had some, looked at you and said, why are you doing that? Why are you making waves? Even if we lose in the eyes of the world and fellow believers, where it really counts is with God. Third thing, that stone. Remember that verse I read in Judges 20, verse 16? Among all this people, there were 700 chosen men, left-handed. Everyone could sling stones at a hairbreadth and not miss. Remember that? The word that I'm asking you if you caught was the left-handed part. We looked at the everyone slinging stones within a hair's breadth at the first time. Now we're going to look at the left-handed part. In the Old Testament, how many people were famous for being left-handed? One, two, three? Actually, quite a few. Three examples. Judges 3:15. When the children of Israel cried unto the Lord raised them up a deliverer, Ehud, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, a left-handed man. And by him the children of Israel sent a present unto Eglon, the king of Moab. You remember that. He's left-handed, so he hides that small dagger on his right side, and he goes in there to the king, and he goes like this and whips it out, and the dirt came out of Eglon, and that was the end of him. Left-handed guy, Benjamite. Second, Judges chapter 20, verse 15 and 16. Now we're going to add verse 15. And the children of Benjamin were numbered at that time out of the cities, 26,000 men that drew the sword beside the inhabitants of Gibeah, which were numbered 700 chosen men. Among all this people, there were 700 chosen men left-handed. Everyone could sling the stones at a hair's breadth and not miss. They're Benjamites. The 700 that are accurate within a hair's width are Benjamites. 1 Chronicles chapter 12, verse 2. They were armed with bows, and they could use the right hand and the left hand in hurling stones and shooting arrows out of a bow. Listen to this. Even of Saul's brethren of Benjamin. Three different places in Scripture it is pointed out that Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, and descendants from Benjamin are left-handed. And the point isn't that, oh, is David left-handed? No, David's not left-handed, he's right-handed. Rather, the point is they were all from the tribe of Benjamin. Where was Saul from?
Benjamin.
This is going to come up later when we talk about David again. I find it biblical irony that David used a stone shot from a sling, a weapon for which Saul and his fellow tribesmen were famous for using, to kill the giant enemy of Saul that Saul was obviously afraid of. The biblical irony there is thick. And in the unrelated account in 1 Chronicles 12, the only connection is that David is running from Saul. That passage points out that those mighty men came alongside of David. They were Benjamites like Saul. And when we talk about the next time, just save it. Saul, why couldn't you use the sling and the stone to kill Goliath? You're the Benjamite. How come David had to do it? You are the one charged with the responsibility to deliver Israel from the Philistines. Whenever someone is in disobedience, the door is open for someone else to be obedient and get the blessing. Back in 1 Samuel 17. Verse 48. Came to pass, when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hastened and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took thence a stone, and he slung it. Now, slung right or slung? Just asking. And smote the Philistine in his forehead, that the stone sank into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. All right. In this case, the giant becomes a dwarf, and the dwarf becomes the giant slayer. I stretch it a bit, maybe calling David a dwarf, but compared to Goliath, think of it this way, round numbers. If, perchance, if, and he would be above average, David were 6 feet tall, and Goliath is 10 foot 9 inches, David is still only two-thirds of the height of Goliath. So he's a dwarf. Okay. Here we go. One has Yahweh and one does not. Look at verse 50. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone. He smote the Philistine and slew him. There was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood upon the Philistine. There you go. Picture that. Standing on the guy. Stands upon him, drew the sword out of its sheath thereof, and slew him, and cut off his head therewith. When the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they took off running. David does what is, this sounds gross to us, but is culturally normal. He decapitates the giant, and he takes the trophies of war, including the head, to his tent. What should have been Saul's trophies of war and would have bolstered his standing with his people and impressed them, instead becomes further proof that David is the one who's really supposed to be the king over Israel. It's interesting that the sin of blasphemy, which he's guilty of, Goliath, was punishable by stoning. And stoning meant that the inhabitants of the village or the town took the guilty person outside the town and they all participated in stoning him. So what does that mean? Lots of stones. But David kills Goliath with a single well-placed stone. Verse 52. The men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines until you come to the valley to the gates of Ekron. The wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way of Sha'arim, even unto Gath and Ekron, and those are the cities of the Philistines. And the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistines, and they spoiled their tents. And David took the head of the Philistine, brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. Now, this may sound counterintuitive for our time and culture, but here's a lesson from this. David, relish your victory. Relish your victory. Counterintuitive to what we would think. What did America do when it vanquished all the enemies in World War II? didn't gloat over all those nations. It rebuilt them. We rebuilt Germany. We rebuilt France. We rebuilt Italy. We rebuilt Japan. We tried to rebuild China, but they went communist. It's counterintuitive. But relish the victory. Your faith has earned it. God wants us to remember the victories because they grow our faith. If every time he did something marvelous and preserved you or protected you, and you never shared it with anyone, who gets glory? Nobody. You're not telling people. God has honored your faith. Now honor the God of the battle and share his faithfulness with others who may be encouraged by how the Lord has worked in your life. The account ends with Saul sounding a lot like that guy I mentioned who couldn't walk across the stage this morning. Who's this? Who's that guy? Saul saw David go forth against Philistine. He said to Abner, the captain of the host, "Abner, whose son is that youth?" And Abner said, "As my soul liveth, O king, I cannot tell." And the king said, "Inquire of whose son the stripling is." Can you think of any more derogatory small terms to apply to David? And as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. What a picture. And Saul said, "Whose son art thou, thou young man?" David answered, "I'm the son of thy servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." Had David not been ministering to Saul already? And Saul couldn't remember who he was? Did not Saul offer to give him his armor just a half hour ago? And Saul can't remember who he is? Phew. Do not be intimidated by the giants. Don't. Trust the weapons God has given you. They're trustworthy. He's trustworthy. And rejoice in and share the victories, especially with the brethren and then with the lost when you have an opportunity.